Hi there, you are on to us here, listening to The Third Degree, our environment and social justice half hour. My name's Simon Unwin, and last week we had a couple of guests who came into the studio and had a wide-ranging chat about sustainability, environmentalism, indigenous sovereignty, and the end of civilization. So we're going to play that for you today, and the two people that we had in, one of them was Franklin Lopez. He's a filmmaker, he's the director of End Civ, a film that examines the self-destructive side of contemporary global civilization and how cultures of resistance could form to deal with that. And it's based largely on the philosophy of Derek Jensen, quite a famous author from the States. Now, Franklin is currently touring that film around Australia, and joining him is Linda Rose from The Anarchy Show, which is broadcast out of Brisbane's totally legendary community radio station 4ZZZ. So we started off talking to Franklin about his film, because it deals with several of the premises that Derek Jensen came up with in his book Endgame, hence the title of the film. And some of those ideas are pretty self-evident, like the idea that industrial civilization is pretty unsustainable. But at the same time, stating these ideas really boldly and exploring them is really confronting. So I started by asking Franklin why he thought that is still confronting.
I think mainly because we've been used to these lifestyles that industrial civilization facilitates. And so I think one of the largest challenges to people is, one is to realize that this way of living cannot continue. So what that means in practical terms is that, like, for instance, we see these lights on here, we see this way this radio station is operating, we see all the cars in the streets, or how we get our food, like all those things have to cease. Because they're basically based on unsustainable systems of electricity production or even food production. And sometimes I think people need to remind themselves what sustainable is. It's a word that's been used to death by mainstream environmental organizations and environmentalists. But sustainability, what it means is that whatever you take from nature, nature has enough time to grow it back or to put it back, so that you never run out of that one particular thing. And pretty much we've consumed the majority of nature right now. And that's not an exaggeration. One of the things that Derek Jensen always likes to hammer is that, for instance, 90% of the fish in the ocean are gone. And that's because we overfish the oceans. If people need proof of this, all you need to look is at the eastern seaboard of North America and see that there's no cod left. It was completely overfished. Same goes with the western seaboard of Europe. Right now, on the west coast of Canada, we're facing with the extinction or the collapse of the salmon fisheries. And so that's just one example. You know, we can go down the line. You know, there's only 2 or 3% of all gross forest left. Most of the prairies are gone, et cetera, et cetera. And so we need nature to live. I mean, that's irrefutable.
Yeah.
And so if this way of living is destroying nature, then this way of living, this culture that we call civilization, has to end. There's no two ways about it.
So I think that's going to be another quite confronting idea for people to encounter in the film, is that it's very much an argument against the idea of civilization itself. And yeah, I mean, how do you speak to people about that who haven't come across these ideas before, you know, who feel really threatened by that idea of, you know, the end of civilization?
Yeah, I think mostly it's because civilization, the term civilization, it's usually used in the positive. The word uncivilized gets used in the negative. But when you look at civilization as a culture and mostly as a construct of hierarchies, that was essentially born by the creation of large-scale agricultures. I mean, that's when you get these ideas of property and working classes and whatnot. You know, this all predates Marx. This all predates capitalist theory. Then you begin to understand that civilization is not such a nice thing. Now, when you see so-called uncivilized cultures, like the ones you have here in Australia that are still amongst us, those so-called uncivilized people have been living in this land for 40 or 50,000 years, depending on who you ask, without depleting nature and actually living quite sustainably within the land base, never overpopulating, never over harvesting, I guess, wild meats and whatnot. And so they essentially had an overall higher quality of life than what we have here in so-called civilized societies. And so when you start looking, when you start basically unpacking the whole thing, you start to see that it's really not such a controversial idea. Civilization is not the only, it's not the only game in town. It's just the one that's more visible. Thankfully, we still have, like I said, indigenous folks like in Canada and in the U.S., who still maintain sustainable lifestyles and who can still remind us of what it's like to live in harmony with nature.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, your comments about civilization not being the only game in town. At the moment, I'm reading Guns, Germs and Steel by Jared Diamond, which is an amazing book that tries to go back as far as one can into history and look at why what we term civilization arose in some parts of the world and not in others. And the conclusion of the book is that there's this whole range of really complex factors that have gone into it. But, you know, one kind of civilization was able to outcompete the others. And that's what we've sort of ended up here with, this really very competitive, very destructive civilization.
And now we have a global civilization. So like in the past, civilizations would usually collapse because they would basically eat up the land base around them, and then people were left with no food or whatnot. And essentially people fled the cities, which is the ultimate construct of civilization. It's the creation of these like mega population sites, which we call cities. But right now, mostly because of petroleum, which is one of the most amazing sources of energy out there, civilizations has been able to expand within very far away from its original land bases, and has been able to populate. This culture of civilization has been able to populate, or basically to grab almost the entirety of the world. And so this civilization, you know, this global civilization will collapse. You know, make no mistake about it. We haven't found a source of energy that equals the versatility of fossil fuels. But the biggest argument that Jensen makes in his books, and that I echo in the film, is that we cannot wait for it to collapse. We need to dismantle it. We need to destroy it before it takes with it the last bits of nature that we have left. If we want to have something left for future generations, we need to make sure that we stop the burning of fossil fuels, you know, down to zero emissions, and we need to stop the wholesale clear cuts of ancient forests. We need to stop overfishing the oceans, and we need to stop mining the way that we have. And what we're looking for is for people to get active and start building cultures of resistance to actually oppose and eventually win at destroying civilization.
A particular tension that's very very present a lot of the time in environmental movements and in the mainstream conversation more generally is this tension between sustainability and sustainable development, or if you like, you know, environmentalism being about, you know, a battle to save civilization, or is it a battle to save, you know, the planet on which it's built? I mean, do you see that resolving itself in, at least in the environmental movement in the future? I mean, as these pressures become more and more acute?
I think as far as like environmental NGOs like Greenpeace and Sierra Club and the others, I don't think that matter will ever be resolved. You know, you can look through their websites and you can see that their main goal is to maintain this system, to maintain capitalism, you know, let alone like they don't even touch civilization. And capitalism requires unlimited growth. And we live on a finite planet. And so those, you know, this idea of capitalism and sustainable capitalism is completely asinine, and it makes no sense. And, you know, I think that putting that aside, there's a radical environmentalist a movement out there, especially in the U.S. and Canada, that are going beyond the limited analysis that the environmental NGOs have. And but are still, I think, needing a little push in order to become more militant and to actually create the cultural resistance that's needed. So basically, these are the folks who will fight corporations and who will lock themselves down to machinery or tree set. You know, they understand that, you know, there's no asking nicely of these corporations. But I think that where they fall short is that, you know, they are mostly trying to save pieces of forest here or endangered species here, instead of, you know, looking at, you know, having a long view and trying to bring the whole thing down, because all they're doing right now is basically putting out fire. And you know, I should also mention that I have the deepest respect for these folks because they're amazingly brave. But, you know, this is a friendly critique, because I think that these are the folks that are closer to our point of view.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of self-reflexivity, if you like, about the environment movement is something that we try, not always successfully, to do on our show as well, to have those conversations about, you know, what needs to happen within our movement and what needs to be discarded in terms of attitudes and tactics and that sort of thing. One of my favorite parts of the film actually was the part where Derek Jensen gets a bit playful and compares environmentalists to the Rebel Alliance in Star Wars. I'll play that back.
I don't know if you know this, but the original draft of the movie Star Wars was not written by Lucas. The original draft was written by environmentalists, and it's a little bit different. For one thing, it wasn't actually called Star Wars. It was called Star Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. But the plot of Star Wars, for those of you who don't remember, is that the Empire has created this giant machine called a Death Star. And it's a machine that's capable of destroying entire planets. In the movie, the rebels find a way to destroy the Death Star. And then at the very end, Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters and to drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust port and to blow up the Death Star. Once again, the first draft of the movie, written by environmentalists, was a bit different. The rebels didn't actually blow up the Death Star. Instead, they used other methods to slow the intergalactic march of empire. For example, they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. Their purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support his decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors, and they'll leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. Now, we all know that that would be enough not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to even the eyes of the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on planets about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few of the rebels sneak aboard the Death Star, and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment, and stirring debates are held on screen as to whether the rebels should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. But there's more. Once inside the Death Star, there's a splinter group breaks off, they burn a couple of transporters, and they etch Galaxy Liberation Front. And then another group breaks off from that group, and they finally make it to Darth Vader's private room. And when they get there, they sneak up behind him, and they hit him with a vegan cream pie. And the directors decided to cut that because it was way too close to a scene in another movie they were developing at the same time called The Plot to Pie Hitler. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And those rebels are generally shouted down by the pacifist rebels, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must, above all else, have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he, too, was once a child. So finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up, and they tell these others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And the rest of the rebels, of course, are just horrified. There's a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and the two robots on one side and the pacifists on the other. And the pacifists chase those four from the room and from the film, which is not a big deal because they're minor characters anyway. But anyway, the way the movie ends is that the Death Star looms closer and closer. And then you see the Death Star, and then you see the planet, and then you see the Death Star. You see the planet, and then you see the Death Star, and you see the lasers start to glow this hellish red, and then you see the planet again, and they see this little light, and what that is, that's the environmentalists getting away before the planet gets blown up. And you see the Death Star again, and then it blows up the planet. And then the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times that devotes a full three sentences to the destruction of the planet. So it's like, yeah, we got some press.
That metaphor is very powerful, because it sort of it really brings home the need for that actual culture of real resistance and I guess what that would require, which is very confronting as well.
Those were the first words that I've ever heard Derek Jensen speak in New York City in 2006. And from that moment on, he not only captured my imagination and my attention, but also of the hundreds of people who were there listening to him. And I think that maybe if I would have started the film maybe a couple of years later, I would have done the environmentalist version of Avatar. What would happen if, I forget the name of the people, the Nubi or something? Like
that? Navi, yeah.
The Navi. What if the Navi, instead of fighting, you know, this corporation that was going to destroy their land in order to mine this mineral they called unobtainium, what if instead of doing that, they signed petitions, you know, they locked themselves down to trees, or they pied, you know, the evil CEO of the corporation. I mean, I think people get, you know, the ridiculousness of what that film would be. It would not be the same film, and people understand that the Navi had to fight in order to save their land, the same way the Rebel Alliance had to destroy the Death Star in order for them to save their planet. And I think most people out there understand who the enemy is. It's just that we're so busy with our own lives, or, you know, we're actually pretty pacified by our middle class like lifestyles. You know, we get three square meals a day. You know, we can watch entertainment in the evening. You know, that we ourselves are invested in this destructive system. And I think that's one of the hardest things to do, is to, people need to decolonize themselves, decolonize their minds, and sort of look at what this lifestyle not only costs nature, but what it costs, like, people in the third world who are slaving to basically prop up our lifestyles here in the first world.
Yeah, I mean, when you say decolonize, that's actually an interesting word that kind of, I don't know about other cities in Australia, Linda, but it's been thrown around that word in Sydney as an idea, decolonize.
Is this with the Occupy movement?
Yeah, well, partly, because, I mean, I think in any settler colonial society, the word occupy is going to be controversial if you're going to try to use it to describe an occupation in a positive sense. And some people were pushing for it to be, you know, renamed decolonized, because that would illustrate a lot more the kind of letting go of privilege that had to be done if that movement was going to really have any kind of liberating impact.
When Occupy Brisbane started, I started campaigning for the acknowledgement of the traditional owners. And when I was doing that, I came across the same issue was happening in Sydney, that the traditional owners were unhappy with the Occupy movement, and I guess the term Occupy as well, that they weren't being acknowledged. And I don't know, like, Queensland is, I guess, seen maybe as a kind of like a more redneck, racist state, perhaps, than New South Wales. But a lot of people had trouble with the whole issue of traditional owners or acknowledging the Indigenous people in Brisbane. And, yeah, I wanted to take it a step further and call it, like, decolonize Brisbane. It just, I think it would have been too much for people to... Mm. But I guess also coming back and explaining to people what exactly that means.
As far as the word, as it's been used in Sydney in the last few years by the activist kind of milieu in Sydney, there was actually, it's been running for a couple of years on and off, but this anarchist-leaning punk festival called Decolonize, which originally happened around Invasion Day a few years ago in January. And that first one was had a lot of workshops and speak-outs from, you know, from people about Indigenous sovereignty issues. And in the years since, it's kind of that part of it has trailed off a little, and it's become a little bit more just about...
It's all about the music.
Yeah, for its own sake. And I guess there were some conversations at the festival last year about, you know, why that was problematic and should we be using this word to describe the festival anymore, or should we instead put more effort into living up to the name, you know? Yeah. But in terms of while we're speaking about decolonization and Indigenous sovereignty, you guys were both at the commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy in Canberra last week. Do you want to speak a little bit about what your experiences were there?
Well, coming from Canada, where I've been living for the past 6.5 years, and where a lot of the activists that I'm involved with have put on the top of their list of struggles is the issue of Indigenous sovereignty, I was amazingly happy to find a similar affinity with local settlers, white activists, supporting the same struggle over here with the issue of Aboriginal sovereignty. And it's just one of the most pleasant things I've done in a long time. Not only was the camp very easygoing and amazingly well organized, I don't think I've been to such a organized camping experience, like a group camping experience, but the spirit of the Aboriginal people that I met and that I encountered chanting on the streets during the march was amazingly inspiring, mostly because when you take into consideration the abuse and violence and ultimately that they've been going through an ongoing process of genocide, and now we have this, you know, they have this thing called the intervention in the Northern Territories. Even with all of that, these folks still have a tremendous fighting spirit. And never did I feel their passion die down, you know, where, you know, I've been to hundreds or if not thousands of protests in my life, and I never quite experienced like the fervor of these folks. And so I think that that's something that we need to look at. We think that our problems are big. You know, you think our problems are big. Just look at the problems that Aborigines face here in Australia and still look at them for inspiration, because they're still going to fight. And I think that if with our solidarity, we can all win this fight together.
Yes, sovereignty was never ceded. And that was something that people at the Tent Embassy, there were meetings of groups of, I think it was done by state, first of all, of the Aboriginal nations. And I think it's been spearheaded by Michael Anderson, who's I think he's the remaining of the four people who started the Tent Embassy on January 26th. And they're looking to restate that sovereignty was never ceded, and to, I guess, yeah, start the decolonization process. Franklin knows a bit more about this.
Yeah, so they decided to, evolve this whole thing from an Aboriginal Tent Embassy to an Aboriginal Parliament. And so it was actually very exciting to be there at the very beginning, where they're actually forming this framework for deciding their future. And one of the things that they decided was that after, you know, we'll create these proposals in group here, and after we create them, we'll go back to our communities and we'll report back to them before we decide anything. And then we will reconvene and then make these decisions. And, you know, if we want to talk about a truly, like, sort of democratic process, these folks were creating that right there. And it was a true honor to actually witness its birth.
I think it's interesting to speak about the various Aboriginal nations of Australia, because although there is this awareness that there were different language groups and so on, I think that, compared to, say, a place like Canada, there's less awareness of the fact that Aboriginal people pre-invasion were not just one culture, but, you know, many nations. It's interesting to kind of discuss the differences in the way that Indigenous people are referred to in various, you know, settler colonial societies.
I think when Franklin arrived in Australia, I remember at the first screening, he was saying he made the film for North American audiences. And, I mean, straight away I saw similarities between the Australian experience, or the Indigenous Australian experience, and the Indigenous American and Canadian experience. And I think that's something that's been striking him, having been in Australia and going to the tent embassy, is that the issues are very similar.
Same invaders and same sort of colonization playbook down to the smallpox. It's uncanny how the similarities are there. And I my hope is that we can find a way to connect Indigenous and Aboriginal peoples and also Maori people in New Zealand, create international solidarity for their own movements, right? They're facing the same thing and the same still ongoing genocide to this day.
The week or so that's followed since the demonstration in Canberra, we've seen a quite amazing overreaction from a lot of the Australian mainstream media. And I mean, how's it felt to kind of have been at this when it happened, and then to watch, I guess, what's unfolded in the mainstream conversation since?
Yeah, I guess it just reinforces the extreme bias and the exaggerations of the mainstream media. I mean, to call what happened on the Thursday afternoon of Australia Day, when someone got a call to say that Tony Abbott was in a nearby cafe, the Pork Barrel Cafe. And to call what happened a riot is just like a tiny little bit of an exaggeration. People were angry outside the cafe, there's no doubt about that. But yeah, I think if the police had just probably stopped... I mean, the funny thing is that Julia Gillard, who ended up, it was the main focus, and someone grabbed her shoe
after she dropped it.
I think at first no one actually knew she was there, because I was there almost from the beginning, because I was right near where the person took the phone call, at the Canberra Indie Media Centre in the park, and no one realised that Julia Gillard was there at first. So as far as there being any sort of security problem or whatever,
I can tell you, and I was taping and I have footage to prove it, that nobody came near the Prime Minister. You can even look at the photos and everybody's like feet away from her, you know. The most physical interaction that she had was with her security detail. The violence that I experienced was the police punching and kicking and pushing Aboriginal people. That's the violence that the media didn't focus on. I just want to put one last thing in there. I think analogies do a great service to explaining complex issues. And I forget who said it, but you know, if you really want to understand colonization, just imagine you live in your house, in your house that you own, and I come by and I kick you out of your house. And I say, you know what, I think it might be okay for you to sleep in the yard. I mean, like, you know, not to boil it down to an oversimplistic analogy, but that's basically what's happened. You know, if any of us were invaded by somebody who basically took over the place that we live, we'd be rightly pissed off. And I think that has to be more than acknowledged. It has to be repaired.
You're on 2SER. This is The Third Degree, and we were speaking there with filmmaker Franklin Lopez and Linda Rose from 4ZZZ Brisbane's Anarchy Show. And they were in the studio last week having a chat with me. Yeah, it was a really interesting discussion. If you want to see Franklin's film, End Civ, which we were discussing earlier in the program, you should go to endciv.com. So that's endciv.com. It's a very interesting watch as well. So that is it for this week. Enjoy the daily. Up next on 2SER. Thank you.